Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on targeting c-MET overexpression and genomic alterations in non-small cell lung cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Jeremy Siegel, Alex Ajay, Rebecca Heist, and Sandeep Patel discuss the complexities of MET dysregulation and emerging therapeutic approaches. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from MABPE. Let's begin with Dr. Jeremy Siegel, practicing pathologist who provides an overview of the molecular biology of MET and the different ways in which MET dysregulation can manifest in non-small cell lung cancer.
Today, we have a pretty nice picture of how MET signaling works. It's a receptor tyrosine kinase. It has its extracellular domain, which is involved in binding to HGF. And when it binds, then you get a dimerization of the receptor. And when you bring the two tyrosine kinase domains together, and you have these different domains on the intracellular portion, you have a tyrosine kinase domain, a juxtamembrane domain, and this docking site domain. And you bring these together, and the tyrosine kinase domains will phosphorylate each other, and that fully activates the tyrosine kinase, and then the tyrosine kinase will go on to phosphorylate other tyrosines. The docking site tyrosines, they serve as docking sites for important signaling factors like GAB1 and GRB2, which go on to activate a lot of downstream signaling, classical pathways. But then eventually you want to turn this system off. You don't want it to just be active all the time. And that's where the juxtamembrane domain comes in. This is actually the binding site for the ubiquitin ligase CBL, which comes here, and it'll ubiquitinate the receptor and cause the whole system to be degraded. And that's how MET signaling is turned off. But it's really kind of interesting. There's a lot of different ways that you can dysregulate MET and that MET gets dysregulated in various tumors. One basic mechanism you could think of, if one receptor is good, then why not make three, right? Just let's put more MET on our cell, and then we're going to get more signaling out of it. So that is MET overexpression. So if you think about how to get overexpression, there's unfortunately a lot of different mechanisms that you can have that will produce overexpression. The first that you could think of, if you've normally got two copies of DNA and two copies of a gene per cell, let's just make a lot more copies of the gene. Then we're going to get more of the protein out of it. And that is MET amplification, right? When you actually have more copies of the DNA. So when you're dealing with more copies of the DNA, then you can use a DNA-based assay in order to try to detect it. So MET amplification is sort of a special case where you have a DNA-based approach that you can use to see if it's there. And you can either use fluorescence in situ hybridization, where you can see additional copies of MET, or this is data from our large-scale NGS DNA panel. And you can see all the different chromosomes from 1 to 22, and some gains and some losses. And then here you can see a big whopping gain for MET, and that's how we detect high-level MET amplification in our DNA NGS panels. So that's its own biomarker in a sense, but it is also considered one of the methods for getting overexpression. But there's a lot of other methods, right? You could think about increasing the transcription rate so you just get a lot more RNA out of the same amount of DNA. Or you could increase the export of the RNA into the cytoplasm, or increase the stability of the RNA. Or you could increase the translation and the processing of the protein. Or even adjust the stability of the protein so it stays on the cell surface longer. All of these are going to be ways that you can make more protein on the surface. But we don't have assays in the lab that can sort of really pick this apart. Unfortunately, it would be really cool if we did, but we don't. And so all you can do at this point, if you want to see if there's more MET on the surface of the cell, is to just look for that. And the biomarker that you really kind of end up with having to deal with is immunohistochemistry, which I say it like it's a bad thing. In some ways, it's kind of frustrating, but it has the definite pro that you're going to be able to detect MET overexpression regardless of the mechanism, right? No matter how it's being made in larger amounts, you'll be able to see it. The cons of getting into IHC for a treatment-related biomarker is the different possibilities for variability, right? We have multiple different antibody clones that can be used, so different labs may be using different ones. They may stain differently. Tissue fixation, right? Different labs may be fixing their tissue differently, and even within the same lab, you could have different amounts of fixation time, and that, you know, can play havoc with the amount of staining that you're going to get when you try to do IHC. And then there's different interpretive schema as well, right? So you're typically dealing with a 0, 1 plus, 2 plus, 3 plus type of thing. But what counts as positive? And so some of the newer studies that have used IHC for treatment, including the Taliso-V study, they used only membranous staining, whereas some of the older clinical trials that were run used both membranous and cytoplasmic, and some of those trials didn't work out. And one of the possible reasons for that is including these cases, which maybe aren't as functionally active. So you've got that going on, and you've also got interpathologist variability, right? You've got a slide, and you've got to give it one of these numbers, but it could be in between here, and some pathologists might call it 2, and some might call it 3, and so you've got, you know, variability issues there too. So there's a lot of possible variability issues with IHC. But for overexpression, this is where you pretty much have to be. I just want to summarize quickly, and I think this will hopefully help for the rest of the discussion. You know, 5 kind of major things that can go wrong with MET in tumors. The first being overexpression, which you know, is quite common at diagnosis. Amplification being one sort of subset of overexpression, which has different clinical features, right? It's not very common at diagnosis, but it's very much associated with treatment resistance, whereas overexpression by other methods is kind of the opposite. And then your mutations, your tyrosine kinase domain mutation, which is very rare as a primary thing. Whereas it can be common in other tumors like papillary renal cell carcinoma, it's very common, but as a primary thing in your lung cancer is very little, but also very much associated with resistance. The exon 14 skipping mutations present in about 3-4% of cases at diagnosis, not so much associated with the resistance, and the fusion is just very rare in general. So it really comes down to, like, if you're going to try to do a comprehensive analysis for MET, you're kind of stuck. There isn't one assay you can do to cover all of these, right? You can use DNA NGS for most of your stuff and most of your mutations, including your exon 14s, as long as that NGS assay is designed properly for the exon 14 skipping mutations. Otherwise, you can go to RNA NGS. If you want to do the fusions, you're kind of in the RNA NGS or fish bucket, and just overexpression by various different mechanisms. You know, really, IHC is your best bet. So some sort of multiple technology approach is really necessary for comprehensive MET alteration assessment.
Recognizing the diverse forms of MET dysregulation is critical for understanding targeted treatment approaches. Now, let's dive into current treatment strategies by hearing from medical oncologist Dr. Alex Agyei, who outlines current MET targeted therapies, including strategies for MET exon 14 skipping mutations and MET overexpression.
So, in thinking about the agents that we have in the clinic now, we can group them into 2. If I actually start from the right, the type 2 ones that are ATP competitive, but they bind to a hydrophobic pocket and they bind to the inactive conformation. So there's some disadvantage there that the potency depends on activating of the MET protein. And as you can see, they are all sort of the non-specific, multi-targeted agents. The most common that you've all used will be cabozantinib. And then the type 1 on my left are the MET-specific and also non-specific. So crizotinib is type 1, and this just means that it binds to the active conformation, but as you all know, it's less specific. It inhibits a lot of other targets. And then the other 4, tepotinib, cabmatinib, savolitinib, they are all 1B. They are very specific. So I think these days we've gotten away from just sequencing the tumor of the patient who has adenocarcinoma. And for most of us, we tend to, if we can, sequence the tumor of every lung cancer patient. And so I know sometimes in some quarters, if it's a squamous cancer patient, particularly somebody who previously smoked, we might not bother to sequence the tumor, but just keep in mind that they may have an exon 14 skipping mutation. I've pulled out some of the toxicities we see that sometimes can be challenging if you haven't treated a lot of these patients. You know, they tend to have edema, and they can have hypoalbuminemia also. So when we're doing the phase one, initially when we saw these patients, we said, low albumin, that's why they have the edema. But the mechanism seems to be much more complex than that. The other thing is that the edema is normally not responsive to diuretics. So you look at it more like how you see lymphedema back in the days with the patients with breast cancer and so on. So it's more elevation, compression, you notice it early and you stop your treatment or resolves, and you might challenge them with treatment later. There's nausea and vomiting, it can actually be severe, creatinine goes up, and there's transaminitis. And there have been a number of studies. My former group at Mayo actually reviewed records, and they went back to the patients who had been treated with tepotinib or capmatinib and didn't really find, it wasn't a big study, but they didn't find any significant differences between PFS and toxicity and so on. So these two are available. The choice is yours. One thing I'll say, though, is that tepotinib is once a day and capmatinib is twice a day. So that might be a difference as you pick the ones to use for your patients. And then, like all our kinase inhibitors, you use them and patients develop resistance. And so with MET, what are the mechanisms? And it's fairly similar to the other TKIs in that you actually have the acquired resistance being on target, in the sense that there are mutations in the MET gene itself conferring resistance, and then you have off-target mutations in the RAS-MAP kinase pathway and so on that also contributes to resistance. At this time, it's not like EGFR, we don't have agents available that will target some of these resistance mechanisms, but it's something to keep in mind. And in this paper, there's a question whether the type 2 MET TKIs, the multi-targeted ones I showed, might have effect in some of these resistance mutations. But this is ongoing work.
Dr. Rebecca Heiss now discusses the clinical rationale and trial data supporting the use of antibody drug conjugates, particularly tilisotuzumab vedotin, in patients with high c-MET overexpression.
So the question for today is, can c-MET overexpression guide your treatment or clinical trial choices? So c-MET dysregulation, you've heard a lot in detail about the different ways that MET can be altered in lung cancer. And I think of these generally in terms of things that I consider oncogenic drivers. So I think about MET exon 14 skipping, high-level MET gene amplification, and MET fusions as really driver events. There are things that when I see them, I think, oh, this is what's making the cancer a cancer. I'm really going to go for targeted therapy here. One thing to keep in mind, and I think Dr. Siegel touched on this earlier, is that you can't interchange these for each other. So the presence of MET overexpression doesn't automatically mean that you have either MET gene amplification or MET exon 14 skipping, for example. This was a study done with multiple institutions, and they took, you can see with this pie chart, that among those lung cancers that were MET IHC positive, only a very small percentage of them actually had MET exon 14 skipping mutations or MET gene amplification. And then similarly, among those that didn't have IHC overexpression, there were some that were MET amplified. And so they're not surrogates for each other, and it really is the case that you have to look for each of these different alterations specifically because they don't substitute for each other. And remember, MET amplification really is happening at the level of the gene, and MET overexpression, as you saw earlier, is happening at the level of the protein. And again, MET overexpression can be hard to call. There is variability among different pathologists about how to call the level of overexpression that you're seeing. This was a study done with a group of lung cancer pathologists, and if you asked them to rate the same slides, there was variability in the percentage of high that was being called. Now, this improved over time as they did consensus conferences, but you can see that the variability in this is something that's made overexpression in particular something that's been a little bit tricky. Now, you've heard about therapeutic targeting of MET. The kinase inhibitors are a very important class of drug, and I think particularly for those oncogenic drivers, they've had great activity. You heard from Dr. Ajay about the activity we see with some of these selective and potent inhibitors. And monoclonal antibodies or antibody drug conjugates are a different class of drugs that, particularly in the setting of overexpression, I think has a pretty big role to play. Interestingly, if you look at the TKI, so the tyrosine kinase inhibitors that we saw had the great activity in MET exon 14 skipping, if you look at those drugs, if you look at overexpressing tumors, the response rates really are not as good as what you see, for example, with MET skipping. So this was a study of capmatinib where they looked among MET high overexpressing tumors, and the response rate is 24%. That's good, but it's not the 60-plus percent that you were seeing with the MET skipping, whereas with high gene copy number, there was a better response rate in this study, as you can see. So what is telisotuzumab vedotin? This is also called, the old name was ABI-399. This is an ADC, an antibody drug conjugate. So the antibody is directed against c-MET. And it's linked via a linker to the cytotoxic payload, which is MMAE, and that's an antitubulin agent. And so these ADCs really act by targeting the antigen that's expressed on the cell membrane. It gets endocytosed into the tumor cell, and then the cytotoxic payload is released, and then it exerts its antitubulin and cytotoxic effect. And so what are the data? The luminosity study design is shown here. This enrolled patients in multiple different cohorts. There was non-squamous, EGFR mutated, non-squamous, EGFR wild type, squamous cohorts. These were all enrolled in the stage one part. And then for proceeding along to the stage two, it was really the non-squamous EGFR wild type cohort that had the activity that led to proceeding to the expansion in stage two. And so in that cohort, they're really looking at those non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancers that are wild type for EGFR mutations that have either intermediate or high level c-MET overexpression by immunohistochemistry. And you do have to look for these patients. So screening is really important. In this study, over 3,000 patients were screened or pre-screened. This led to about 1,954 EGFR wild-type non-small cell lung cancer patients who had samples that were evaluable. And then almost a quarter of these were c-MET overexpressing, as defined by at least 25% with IHC 3+. And then 13.5% were c-MET high, and that's at least 50% having IHC 3+. So the primary endpoint here, response, you can see that in c-MET overexpressing non-small cell lung cancer, among the high expressors, the response rate was 34.6%, and among the intermediate expressors, the response rate was 22.9%. So in the population as a whole, response rate of 28.6%. And the median PFS ranging in the 5.5 to 6 month range, and the median overall survival around 14 months. So really, I think, interesting and promising data here with this response rate, particularly in the high overexpressing population. What about the adverse events? The most common adverse events were peripheral neuropathy and peripheral edema. Most of these were grade 1 or 2. They're shown in blue in these bars, with a lower percentage being grade 3 or higher. There were some adverse events of special interest. These ADCs can affect the ocular toxicity, so corneal epitheliopathies were sometimes seen. There were some leukopenia seen, but the rate of febrile neutropenia was zero. And there was some ILD that was seen with this as well. About 10% of these resulted in discontinuation, about 10% due to peripheral neuropathy, and 9% due to ILD. So based on these data, the FDA grants accelerated approval to tisotumab vedotin for non-small cell with high c-MET protein overexpression. So specifically that cohort where at least 50% of the tumor cells had strong 3-plus IHC staining. This is being tested further. This is the phase 3 TELEMET study. So in this study, patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer with overexpressing c-MET by IHC tumors, EGFR wild type, are randomized in a one-to-one fashion to receive either Teliso-V or docetaxel. There's stratification by whether the c-MET status is high or intermediate, whether or not prior immune checkpoint inhibitors were given, and then the region in which the patient is treated. And so just to point out, this study is enrolling both the intermediate and high overexpressing subsets from the Luminosity study. So this study is ongoing, and I think it'll be very important to see these data and see how these patients do in comparison to docetaxel. So going back to our case, Mr. T, who's a 61-year-old, found to have a right lung mass, metastatic lung cancer. Tumor NGS was negative for actionable genomics, treated with carbapem-pembro and then pem-pembro, and then ultimately progressed, and has high c-MET overexpression. Can c-MET overexpression guide your treatment or clinical trial choices? Yes. Tisotumab vedotin was just recently approved for EGFR wild-type non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer with high-level c-MET overexpression, defined as greater than or equal to 50% of tumor cells with a 3-plus IHC MET overexpression. So that is great to have an FDA-approved drug with accelerated approval in this setting. I think that's fabulous news for our patients, and always great to offer more treatment options for our patients. There's also a lot of activity in clinical trials of different drugs in this space. So there are multiple ADCs and antibodies that are being tested. This is just a short list of some of the drugs that are active in clinicaltrials.gov right now. And just to kind of briefly show some of the data, these are just very preliminary looks. AB400 is an ADC directed against MET. It has a different cytotoxic payload, a topoisomerase inhibitor. This was reported 2 years ago at this point at ASCO with a phase 1 monotherapy dose escalation going to a dose expansion. And at that time, some preliminary data showed activity with a response rate of 22% in the colorectal population, and then among all patients, a response rate of 25%. MYTX011 is another ADC reported last year at ASCO, a phase 1 dose escalation going to a part 2 with several dose expansions. Last year, this was in dose escalation, and the TEAEs that reported at that point, things like fatigue and corneal changes and blurred vision, among others. BYON3521, another ADC, with the schema shown here. This is a study that's in progress, reported at AACR a few years ago, both in dose escalation and going into expansion. And then Davutamig, I hope I'm saying that right, REGN5093, this is a MET by MET bispecific antibody. And this has been reported at ESMO of this past year, a dose escalation and expansion. And this had some activity data shown here, and you can see among patients with MET skipping, a response rate of 25%. Among patients with MET overexpression, if you pick out the IHC 3+ of at least 50%, a 17% response rate. And if you go to overexpression of at least 90%, a 31% response rate. So we look forward to kind of seeing more of these studies and these data as they mature. I think in summary, c-MET overexpression is a target for treatment in non-small cell lung cancer. Placetuzumab vedotin received FDA accelerated approval for the treatment of patients with advanced or metastatic non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer with high c-MET overexpression, defined as at least 50% of tumor cells with 3+ staining by IHC. There are many other MET-directed antibodies and antibody-drug conjugates that are in clinical testing. And I think there are a lot of questions as we see these data. It's, as I said, great news that we have another FDA approval. And I think some of the things that we would think about are how do we implement widespread testing? We've already heard of the many different ways that we have to look at testing for the various alterations in MET, and this adds to that. And then also the question of can lower levels of overexpression benefit. This approval is for the highly expressing tumors, and we know there's a range of expression, and so whether or not there can be activity in some of the lower levels of expression is also a question that is still current.
Addressing resistance remains a significant challenge in non-small cell lung cancer management, particularly for patients who initially respond to EGFR inhibitors. In this final segment, Dr. Sandeep Patel explores emerging strategies to overcome resistance to EGFR TKIs and EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer through MET targeted combinations.
And so let's look at this through the lens of a patient case. This is a patient, EGFR exon 19 deletion, advanced non-small cell lung cancer that progressed on two prior lines of treatment, including osimertinib and chemo amivantamab. The patient undergoes repeat biopsy of a progressive liver lesion, and molecular testing as well as immunohistochemical profiling shows the EGFR exon 19 deletion, but also now the presence of high-level c-MET overexpression, 3+. And so we talked a bit about the different diagnostic modalities, and similar to HER2, it's important for us to give the full information. Is it overexpression? Is it mutation? These have different consequences, even if the drugs may sound and look alike. And so immunohistochemistry, fundamentally, we're looking at proteins on the cell surface, and so antibodies target these. For FISH, these are very sensitive ways of looking at structural changes in the chromosome for amplification, for example, especially tissue-based methods. And then next-generation sequencing, whether it be tissue or liquid-based, for detection. And so when we're talking about MET, we heard earlier about exon 14 skipping, which is an aberration. We also have MET overexpression, which we heard different therapeutic consequences. We try to do broad-based profiling for our patients, DNA, RNA, especially in tissue, liquid biopsy for DNA-based changes, protein, immunohistochemistry, and this gives us a comprehensive profile. You heard earlier on MET exon 14, detection can be a challenge, but now we have the added complexity of ordering the right test for the patient. We used to only have exon 14 skipping as a therapeutic modality in the standard of care. Now we actually have to order not only that as part of multiplex NGS, but now MET IHC. And one of the issues we're really having is there are multiple targets in the refractory setting. And while NGS, if you're going to add a panel of genes, typically the tissue input is going to be the same. Every time you do an IHC, you're using another slide. And so the lack of a multiplex IHC is a challenge now in non-small cell lung cancer, where we should test for PD-L1, HER2, MET, soon TROP2 probably as well. And so it's important that when we see these patients, we do molecular testing regardless of smoking history. There's nothing about smoking that protects you from EGFR. It just affects the denominator and the odds at a population level. But that potential patient has an aberration or not, and it's important to test everyone. And so we do make three types of diagnoses in clinic, and I suggest we actually wait for the comprehensive profiling before we treat the radiographic diagnosis, including an MRI of the brain, or at least a CT head with contrast of the brain, pathologic diagnosis, including biopsy of the highest stage non-bone lesion, and then molecular diagnosis, which can be done by liquid biopsy or by IHC, and then increasingly in the refractory space, we're able to act on either HER2, MET, soon potentially TROP2 as well. So MET mutations, these are detected best by DNA, RNA. These are targeted by small molecule inhibitors. You heard about what these are earlier and their side effects. And then MET protein level overexpression, which is currently where antibody drug conjugates such as Telazov have therapeutic activity. Now, an area in which the Telazov study in the approval did not include, but subsequent studies, including combinations of Telazov with osimertinib, did look at, is MET as an aberration for resistance, meaning you didn't have it at baseline, but you developed it while on first-line therapy with a third-generation EGFR inhibitor. And this happens about 10% of the time in terms of MET amplification as a mechanism of resistance. You see here, we get a variety of different other mechanisms of resistance. I think rebiopsy as a paradigm at the tissue level has really been led by EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer, because small cell transformation, for example, can only be diagnosed histologically. And so having that tissue is important not only for the histologic transformation assessment, but also for resistance assessment as well for protein level targets. And so the INSIGHT-2 study is an open label, two-arm phase two study looking at MET amplification as a resistance mechanism, 10% of patients, after treatment with an EGFR inhibitor. And you see here, and I think it's a very important point, the MET amplification definition is tumor biopsy, FISH, liquid biopsy, NGS, but the cutoffs are different. And there's a lot of variability in the assays, especially the liquid biopsies in particular. And so it's important to know what's under the hood on the assay and what a positive result is. And this is for genomic level amplification events. Here, this is a study of tepotinib, which is a small molecule MET inhibitor, combined with osimertinib, with the objective response rate being the primary endpoint here. And we see here really nice responses when we select on the biomarker not only the originating mutation of the EGFR driver, but now the acquired resistance mutation of MET amplification. When we select here, the data is for central FISH, which is probably the most accurate way to do it in tissue. We see here really nice responses in our waterfall plot, and some of these can be ongoing. If you look at the swimmer's plot in the top right corner, there are patients who've been on this combination treatment for 2 years. Many of these patients are probably on EGFR inhibitors third generation inhibitors for a couple years as well. And so we're moving the needle with precision oncology, not only at baseline at diagnosis, but also at resistance as well. And importantly, these small molecule MET inhibitors have CNS activity. And so we see here improvement in the CNS as well, with a quarter of patients having complete remissions, complete eradication of their tumor. And so before we do whole brain irradiation, unless the patient is highly symptomatic, we try to get at least a repeat liquid biopsy, but ideally a tissue biopsy, and do the testing, because many of these aberrations, you can get really nice responses with CNS active agents. Of course, if that patient's in extremis, having symptoms, you can't wait. You have to rely on radiation techniques, including whole brain irradiation. But tepotinib plus osimertinib have a demonstrated manageable safety profile. There's really no major overlapping toxicities, but you get the summation of the toxicities of both agents. In my practice, the peripheral edema, which is really MET-driven, is particularly a vexing side effect. The remainder can generally be well controlled with dose adjustments and supportive care. However, the edema remains a challenge. And so the Savannah study, similar approach, taking savolitinib, which is a CNS-penetrant MET inhibitor, similar to tepotinib, plus osimertinib in patients here who had MET overexpression by HC or amplification by FISH. And the most updated protocol, these were patients that were actually very high IHC expressors, over 90%, or FISH positive. And so you can see here, even amongst a genre of post-EGFR MET resistance, we have some heterogeneity in the biomarker selection in the study design. What we see here, objective response rates over 50%, the vast majority of patients getting RECIST measurable shrinkage, or just shrinkage that doesn't quite cross the threshold. And a duration response, at least by Bicker, approaching double digits. Safety, overall, this regimen was reasonably tolerable, but the class effect of peripheral edema remains a challenge for these patients. Here is a combination study of Telisov, an antibody-drug conjugate targeting MET, in combination with osimertinib. So we switched from a small molecule strategy to now an antibody-drug conjugate strategy. We see our patients at baseline who had EGFR exon 19 or LA58R had progression on frontline osimertinib. These patients were screened by IHC and central IHC here. We see overall these patients are relatively balanced across monotherapy versus combination cohorts, and many of these patients had multiple prior lines of treatment. We see here either by central review or per investigator, really nice responses to patients who'd progressed on osimertinib. And so the teplizumab really is showing its activity here in a slightly different population of the current labels looking at, which is monotherapy here is combination with osimertinib, and with patients almost 70% with a response, median PFS over 6 months. Target lesion size was reduced across patients, and even those patients that didn't have a RECIST level response often had shrinkage, and some of that was durable as well. Now, anytime we're combining agents, the toxicity is concerned. As mentioned, Telazo-V has some of the edema, but really it's the peripheral neuropathy that's our rate-limiting toxicity and dose-limiting toxicity in agents, as well as some of the cytopenias from the payload. And so something to keep in mind as we're treating these patients, and dose adjustments early can have important effect on maintaining dose intensity long-term. It's better to give a lower dose of this drug longer-term than to try to maintain peak and get through the side effects, because these side effects can be permanent. And so this patient on progression, a liver lesion was biopsied, multiple IHCs were stained, small cell transformation was ruled out, and this patient had high level c-MET overexpression. And the patient ended up on going on a trial, Telazo-V and osimertinib, with a nice response. And so it's important for us to test, not guess. How you test matters, what you test matters. It's not enough to say someone's HER2 positive or MET positive anymore. Are they MET amplified? Are they MET exon 14 skipping? Are they MET 3 plus protein level of expression due to the HER2 exon 20 insertion? So you gave the street and the address. And DNA and RNA NGS, in my view, is probably the optimal way to look for MET exon 14 skipping. Liquid biopsies, of course, very reasonable as well. FISH may be more sensitive for amplifications, IHC for overexpression, but the diagnostic informs on the therapeutic strategy, especially for MET, where we're matching generally an antibody drug conjugate to an antibody overexpression detection strategy and a small molecule to a genomic amplification or skipping event. We should test everyone, independent of smoking history, and especially non-squamous. I do test squamous histology as well, especially for rarer smokers. But for non-squamous, I think everyone, regardless of smoking history, should be tested, especially now because we have RAS inhibitors as well. And that for those patients with MET overexpression or amplification with third generation EGFR TKI, consideration of a clinical trial with a small molecule inhibitor plus third generation EGFR inhibitor is warranted, especially after exhausting the standard of care options. We have multiple small molecule strategies, either tepotinib or savolitinib plus osimertinib. Peripheral edema is the rate-limiting toxicity here. ADC strategies, Atelzo-V plus osimertinib, also on deck. Here, peripheral neuropathy is the main barrier to dosing. And so with that, happy to join the panel for discussion.
When do you test for MET overexpression?
Well, I guess I might say I would leave it to the oncologist to decide when they were planning to do it. It's a question, some of it for, you know, on the pathology side, like what tests are we going to reflex and what are we not? This question pulls me in two different directions, because sometimes, you know, it's much easier to set things up as a reflex so that they're done on all the material, but then, you know, I guess we'll probably end up talking about it, but the more IHCs that you add, the more stress you put on the amount of tissue you have, so you may or may not want to do that. And if, you know, the overexpression is going to emerge later at a point where you might want to treat, then you might want to focus it on when you're going to be treating. So it becomes a push-pull between, you know, getting it done comprehensively as part of a reflex and getting it done when it needs to be done. I think it just at each place it probably needs to be a discussion between the oncologist and the pathologist about how to order it and how to get it done and how to do it at the right time.
Yeah.
I think for MET exon 14 skipping, that's part of a multiplex testing strategy up front. I think for MET overexpression, it could be done up front. I tend to do it mainly in the second line, whether it be post EGFR or for patients who got chemo IO or IO up front while looking for multiple IHC targets. It just turns out that initial biopsy that made the diagnosis for the patient after they do all the TTF staining and CK7 and so on, and then you run your NGS, there's just not a lot left. So typically I'll go for the IHC centric strategy on the post progression biopsy.
I agree. I mean, I think, honestly, until now, we're testing it in the context of a clinical trial. You know, but now, with the new approval, it's going to be something we're going to routinely incorporating our testing, but at this time, as Dr. Patel said, probably in the second line setting, just because of the availability of tissue for the things you want to attack in the first line.
So are you routinely now re-biopsying after progression on first line, let's say carbapenem/pembro/pembro? You will routinely re-biopsy at that point?
We do.
Yeah, and increasingly so now that we have multiple approvals of agents in that space. I think HER2, we were looking for IHC, and you could do it at baseline, but now with MET, potentially TROP2, there are too many IHC, and one thing you don't want to do, in my opinion, is burn through the first line tissue using single IHC that you're not going to make a decision until second line, and then not QNS or quantity not sufficient on your NGS, where those markers you need right then and there.
Yep. And is your sense, I'll direct this question to you, is your sense that MET overexpression fluctuates over time?
I guess I'm not sure, but I think it can. It's usually not a resistance mechanism, but then again, the amplification is, and the amplification may cause the overexpression. So I think, you know, I think the answer is possibly yes.
So really worth testing when you're going to use it. So staying on this overexpression topic, so MET overexpression is definitely a target for treatment, and then with the approval of the Ventana assay along with the Teliso-V, what do you think about this actually being taken up in clinical practice? Will people use it?
I always, from the pathology side, we do what the oncologists need, right? So they come back and they say, we want to test this because we want to give this drug, then we'll figure out a way to get it done. And if they're not asking us that, then we won't. So that's another one for you guys. I think I get the feeling that it's going to be taken up and used in practice, but that's a little out of my wheelhouse. But if it is, then you know, the testing needs to be done and it'll get done.
I think so, you know, because these are sort of the non-target expressing tumors, right? Mm-hmm. And after the first line, you're always looking for something to give them other than docetaxel, right? So any assay that might help you decide on some other agent to use, I think we are going to use. I mean, in our institution, we are, to your point, we are talking to our pathologists about when to put it in, should it be, and their sense is the same as yours. You know, if it's reflex in the first line, do you really need it? It might not be enough tissue and so on.
It's an approved therapy. Yeah. The alternatives are docetaxel, which you get neuropathy without as much benefit as we've seen in biomarker selected Teliso-V. And so I think it needs to be part of the standard of care, HER2, MET, maybe TROP2. We'll see. We heard a lot about that at the meeting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. And then we're going to move to a different kind of alterations. Another question that came in from our virtual audience. How do you decide on treatment for patients with MET exon 14 mutations?
So I think up front, I'll go with the small molecule inhibitor, and it'll be tepotinib or capmatinib. I have comfort with both. I've used both. Typically, the out-of-pocket copay drives the decision-making, and you'd be surprised the variance you may see. You prescribe one, you get hit with the number, then you prescribe the other, and it works just fine. But I've seen really nice, durable responses for patients with MET amplification, including with multifocal brain metastasis. And I think the main point, and Dr. John made it very well, is you got to manage the toxicity, dose adjustments, things like that. I think you don't want to prescribe them, you know, 30 days and see them a month later. They'll come back with, you know, very swollen legs, and they'll be very unhappy, rightfully so. You got to treat this like a chemo and see the patient back on a new start next week or at most 2 weeks, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I've been impressed about, in some cases, how durable the response can be.
Yep.
You know, not everybody responds, but those who respond, they tend to do well for a long time.
Yeah. And do you have a sense of any tips, practical tips, for managing the edema?
Yeah, I mean, dose reduce early, I think, rather than late. It is dose dependent. Switching between one to the other doesn't matter because it's just how you're hitting MET, whether it's an ADC or small molecule. Compression socks, compression stockings are helpful. I try Lasix and sometimes it works, but most of the time it doesn't. You're depleting total body water, right? So if that helps, that helps. If it doesn't, you're stuck. But dose adjustments are your best friend.
Yeah, I think the key, and that's what I hope to show, is that you have to look out for it, catch it early and intervene, then it really works. You know, mm-hmm. If you see it early and you have a break, improves and you reduce that dose, works well. But when they come with severe edema, it can be very intractable.
And another question, there's a sense that with the ADC, there's more peripheral neuropathy, with the TKI, more edema. Do you have a sense of why there's that differential in the kinds of adverse events that are seen with the different classes of drugs?
Well, I guess different mechanisms for the drug. If you have an ADC, the thing you don't want is for that ADC to be picked up by other cells, and so it's going to get picked up by some other cells, and it's going to cause some sort of damage where it's going. And with the small molecule inhibitor, you've got the risk of inhibiting MET in other places, or other tyrosine kinases in other places, so that the actual mechanism of damage and off-target effects is going to be different. And I don't know the exact mechanism by which each of these things does one of those two things, but I would imagine that's the reason that you see different things.
Yes, I think, with the ADCs, actually, it's a complex subject, but for instance, if you take the ADCs that have a tubulin payload, you can have similar mm-hmm. side effects even though the target is different. Mm-hmm. So clearly a lot of it is due to the payload, and so with the ADC might not have anything to do with inhibiting MET itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I would concur. I think the peripheral neuropathy is probably the payload. Meanwhile, the edema is mediated by abrogation of MET signaling, whether that is small molecule or antibody mediated.
Yep. And then going back to a pathology question, is there a concordance of MET expression between the primary site and metastatic site? Does it matter where you biopsy if you're going to re-biopsy?
We kind of hit that a little bit. I think for the most part, the overexpression is going to be, I would guess it's relatively stable, because it doesn't seem to be something that reliably shows up as a resistance mechanism. But I don't think, if you have amplification, then I think it can emerge. And, from tumor to tumor and even block to block, you can have variability in staining. So I think there's definitely going to be variability. I think overall, I would say it probably makes more sense to test it when you're going to use it. It's just from a workflow standpoint, it's harder to reflex if you're reflexing at relapse, because the pathologists often aren't aware of when there's relapse or what's actually going on with the patient at the time that they're looking at the material, so they can't really reflex it. It then has to be a discussion or an order placed when it's being done, and that's more challenging, because I don't even think in our system there's a way for oncologists to directly request IHC tests. It's more of like a, email, can you please order IHC on this? Mm-hmm. And so then you've got lots of emails going back and forth about when to test this or whatever, so it just becomes a bit more challenging.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description. We'll see you next time.